1. Disfluencies. Integrate common English fillers and hesitations naturally. Don't overdo it, especially as the speakers are knowledgeable. 1. Disfluencies. Use for pauses while thinking. Example, host speaker. So the next point is about the brain stands, example, you know, sort of kind of as filler words or hedges. Example, expert speaker. It's a, you know, really complex interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Host speaker. That sounds kind of counterintuitive. Example, use false starts or repetitions. Example, expert speaker. The brain activity starts before we're even aware. 2, interruptions and overlaps. Speakers should naturally interrupt or talk over each other slightly, especially to agree, disagree, or ask clarifying questions. The alternating line format helps achieve this. Example, host speaker. So the Libet experiment showed a delay. Expert speaker, right? Significant delay, yeah. About 300 milliseconds before conscious awareness. Host speaker. 300 milliseconds. Wow. And that really challenges our idea of expert speaker. Exactly. The idea that conscious will starts everything. 3, shorter sentences and fragments. Break down longer sentences into shorter ones or even fragments, as people often do in conversation. Example, host speaker. What about determinism? Expert speaker. Well, there were different types. Fatalism, for instance, host speaker, right? Everything's fixed. Expert speaker. Yeah, basically stars, fate, that sort of thing. 4, contractions. Use contractions extensively. It's don't, where, isn't, can't, etc., as they are standard in spoken English. Example, host speaker. It's not always clear why we do things, is it? 5, conversational fillers and connectors. Use words and phrases that connect ideas smoothly in conversation. 5, conversational fillers and connectors. Use well, so, okay, right, exactly. Actually, I mean, you see, example, right. Expert speaker. Well, the traditional view is quite different. Host speaker. Okay, so what does the neuroscience say? Expert speaker. Right, and that leads us to the next point. 6, tag questions. Occasionally use tag questions to invite agreement or check understanding. Example, host speaker. That makes sense, doesn't it? Expert speaker. We're not always rational, are we? 7, colloquialisms and informal language. Use language appropriate for a podcast, engaging and accessible, but still intelligent. Avoid overly academic or stiff phrasing. Example, host speaker. Let's dive into that. Expert speaker. It really flips the script on that. Host speaker. That's a really big question. 8, direct address. Address the listener directly using you. Example, host speaker. You might find this next part particularly interesting. Expert speaker. So you can see how complex this gets. 9, hedging. Use words like might, could, seems, perhaps, often, tend to, when discussing complex or uncertain topics, reflecting scientific caution. Example, expert speaker. It seems like the feeling of will might be secondary. Host speaker. So perhaps it's more about interpretation. 10, flow and pacing. Vary the pace. Some explanations might be slightly quicker, while others require more pauses and deliberation using disfluencies. The back-and-forth structure should prevent monologue-like sections. Example, host speaker. Okay, so what's the alternative view then? Expert speaker. Well, one source suggests looking at neurophilosophy. It uses the problem of evil as an example. Host speaker, right? The classic theological problem.
Expert speaker, exactly. But instead of just free will causing evil, it hints at biological factors, maybe rapid development, or even things like psychopathy linked to reward systems. Host speaker. So biology influencing what we'd normally call a moral choice. Expert speaker. Potentially, yeah, it's a different lens.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling a big one. Something you, our listener, have specifically asked us to explore, the concept of free will.
That's right. We've got a fascinating mix of sources here. Everything from, you know, deep philosophical arguments to the latest discoveries coming out of neuroscience labs.
And psychological studies, too, all trying to understand how much control we really have over our choices.
Our mission today is to wade through these often complex ideas and pull out the truly important nuggets, the insights that help us understand ourselves and our actions better.
Without getting completely bogged down in the really technical stuff.
Exactly. We'll be hearing from philosophers who've been debating this for centuries, brain scientists showing us the machinery, and psychologists with their clever experiments.
And the core of it, as always, is this tension. That strong feeling that we're freely making decisions.
Versus the idea that maybe everything, including our brains, operates by cause and effect.
Yeah.
That maybe our choices are, well, predetermined.
Okay, let's jump right in. Maybe start with some of the foundational philosophical ideas.
Sounds good. Traditionally, Western philosophy has often put humans on a bit of a pedestal. It emphasized our capacity for reason as something separate, you know, from instincts and our physical bodies.
Right, the mind over matter idea.
Pretty much. And in this view, our will, our ability to choose, comes directly from these rational decisions. This framework also underpins the idea of objective morality.
A kind of universal right and wrong based on reason.
Exactly. Rational principles guiding us.
But one of the sources you shared challenges this pretty directly, doesn't it?
It does. It suggests that looking at the brain, this field called neurophilosophy, shows why that traditional separation might not really hold up.
And it uses a really striking example, the problem of evil.
Indeed. The usual theological explanation often brings in free will. God gave us choice. Sometimes we choose badly, hence evil.
The free will defense, yeah.
But this source offers a different angle. It suggests what we see as evil could be linked to the complexities of, say, rapid development or even natural biological variations.
Like psychopathy.
Yes, it mentions psychopathy and how it might connect to differences in brain reward mechanisms. So instead of just a free choice for evil, it could be tied up with our biology.
So biological factors influencing behaviors we usually think of as pure choice.
That's the key insight there, yeah. It really flips the script on a long-standing debate.
It really does. So when philosophers talk about free will, how are they actually defining it?
Well, we have a couple of useful definitions here. One encyclopedia definition says it means a person decides their own actions, not totally controlled by fate, instincts, or higher powers.
Okay, sounds straightforward enough.
Then there's David Hume, the 18th century philosopher. He described will simply as that internal feeling we get when we consciously start a body movement or a new thought.
Ah, so more about the subjective feeling of it.
Exactly. And interestingly, the source points out that this feeling Hume described actually aligns surprisingly well with some recent brain science findings.
So that connection between the inner feeling and the brain mechanics is key.
Very much so.
Hume's definition feels very much like our everyday experience, doesn't it? You decide, you feel like you're initiating it. But then the huge question, is that feeling real or is it just an illusion?
Right. And that leads us straight into determinism, the view that maybe our choices aren't free after all.
What are the main ideas there?
There are several flavors. First, there's fatalism, the idea that whatever will happen. It's unavoidable.
Set in stone, basically.
Yeah, predetermined, whether by stars or a divine plan. The source briefly touches on religious predestination, comparing Calvinism, which emphasizes God's control, with Catholicism's different take.
And the contradiction there is pretty stark, isn't it? A good God predetermining suffering.
It's a major challenge, yeah. How do you square that circle? The key insight is that stark contrast between a completely fixed future and our own feeling of making choices.
That definitely raises profound questions. So fatalism is one end of the spectrum. What's next?
Next is general determinism. This is the belief that all our behavior is fully determined by prior causes. Theoretically, it could be predicted if we knew all those causes.
But we never really know all the causes, right?
Exactly. We usually don't have anywhere near enough information. But determinism says it's possible in principle.
Okay. Any other views?
Then there's the idea that decisions come from internal states that are just way too complex to predict accurately. And also the view that maybe decisions are caused by some kind of external spirit or force.
So the common thread seems to be that our actions result from something outside our conscious control, even if it's super complex or hidden.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
It's interesting how many of these ideas touch on our sense of control, or maybe the feeling that we lack it sometimes.
Definitely. The source mentions a few reasons why we might feel like we're not really in the driver's seat.
Like what?
Things like feeling overwhelmed or sort of pushed by events. Also, our brain's tendency to find patterns everywhere, even in randomness.
The meaning-seeking machine.
Right. And that weird experience of deja vu, feeling like this has all happened before.
That can be unsettling.
And maybe the most powerful example, addiction.
Ah,
yes. Addiction really highlights how internal compulsions can feel like they're overriding our free will, even if we try to rationalize the craving as something we want. It shows how choice can feel severely limited from the inside.
Addiction definitely complicates the idea of totally free choice. Okay, let's loop back to the types of determinism. We had fatalism, general determinism. What about idealistic determinism?
Right, idealistic determinism, in this context, suggests that because God exists outside of time and has perfect knowledge, the entire future is already known to God.
So from God's perspective, it's all laid out.
Exactly. From our limited time-bound view, it might seem like we have free choice, but really, our path is already known. This leads to the doctrine of predestination. Your ultimate fate is set by God's will.
The source mentions John M. Frame on this.
Yes. As a theologian who finds biblical support for this view. But the key tension, again, is the clash with human free will and responsibility.
If it's all predetermined by God's knowledge, how can we be truly accountable?
That's the paradox, debated for centuries. It's a real logical tightrope walk.
It certainly seems like it. Okay, so that's the theological angle. What about scientific determinism? Sounds like that has several branches.
It does. Biological determinism, for instance, that proposes our biology genes, brain structure fully determines our behavior.
So nature over nurture, essentially.
In its strongest form, yes. Within that, you have genetic determinism, the idea that genes dictate everything. But the field of behavioral genetics paints a more nuanced picture.
Right, looking at genes and environment.
Exactly. And the key insight here is that while biology definitely influences us, it's rarely the sole determinant.
This is where Turkheimer's three laws of behavioral genetics come in, based on twin studies.
Precisely. Eric Turkheimer observed, first, all behavioral traits are heritable to some degree. Genes play a role. Second, the effect of being raised in the same family is generally weaker than the genetic influence.
Interesting. So shared environment isn't as powerful as we might think.
Often less powerful than genetics, yeah. And third, surprisingly, a big chunk of the differences between people can't be explained by either genes or shared family environment.
The non-shared environment part.
Right. You see it even with identical twins raised together, they still develop differences. There's even a proposed fourth law. Many, many genes contribute to most traits, each with just a tiny effect.
So genes give predispositions, not blueprints?
Exactly. Plus, we all acquire new mutations, maybe 60 or so per person, which add more subtle variations.
So it's not just the genes we inherit. What other biological factors weigh in?
Oh, lots. The source lists, illnesses, fever, digestion, our gut microbiome.
The gut-brain axis, right?
Absolutely. Blood sugar fluctuations, even tiny environmental differences accumulating over time, like Darwin's finches developing different beaks.
Small changes adding up.
Yeah. And the source makes the interesting point that our brains, always learning, can change faster than other parts of our bodies. The takeaway is our immediate biological state can subtly shift our tendencies, influencing decisions.
That makes sense. Which brings us to neuronal determinism. Brain activity dictates choices.
Yes. This suggests our brain's specific structure and its ongoing activity heavily influence who we are and what we decide.
And that structure is shaped by
a mix of genes, environment, diet, toxins, social interactions, and even culture. The brain's dynamic activity, its neurodynamics, depends on nerve networks, connection strengths.
Synaptic plasticity.
Exactly, how connections change with learning. Also, neuron excitability, neurotransmitter levels, all influenced by biology and experience.
So neuronal determinism isn't a standard term yet, but the idea is gaining ground.
The underlying concept is, yes, that brain state strongly shapes choices. The source mentions how small things, like tiny strokes or gene-environment interactions, can alter brain connections linked to addiction.
But it's not absolutely deterministic. There's randomness.
Right. There's inherent noise in the nervous system. So the outcome isn't always strictly fixed. It's more probabilistic.
Mm.
Our brain state heavily influences, but might not dictate with certainty.
Okay, and our social world plays a huge role too, social determinism.
Exactly. How our interactions shape us. It works through learning social norms, conforming to customs, the power of language, culture.
The bad company example illustrates that well.
It does. Negative patterns get reinforced socially, maybe even changing brain function over time. The insight is we're not islands. Our social world profoundly shapes us.
And then linguistic determinism, language shaping thought.
Yes. Quoting Wittgenstein, the limits of my language mean the limits of my world. The source uses hate speech as an example. Tolerating it can shape underlying thoughts and contribute to real-world violence.
So language isn't just describing reality, it's partly creating it.
That's the idea. And it's part of broader cognitive determinism. Our knowledge, education, attention, expertise, biases all influence behavior. An expert notices things a beginner misses. Even our taste in music is shaped by past experience.
So the tools we think with guide our choices.
Precisely. The key takeaway is that the information we have and how we process it subtly guides us.
It feels like we're constantly being pushed and pulled by all these factors, but we often feel we can resist, make a different choice. How does that fit?
That's a crucial point. We sometimes feel aware of these influences and feel like we can deliberately choose differently.
But is that feeling of resistance itself determined?
That's the underlying question. Is even the decision to resist caused by other factors, maybe hidden ones? The source touches on the brain's complexity and asks if we can ever truly escape the physical cause and effect chain.
It mentions Einstein and space-time.
Briefly, yeah. Suggesting a predetermined universe is one interpretation, but then counters it.
Yeah.
There's no single viewpoint from which all history is laid out. The key insight remains this tension between feeling free and the physical laws governing our brains.
And then we hit the limits of prediction chaos theory, quantum mechanics.
It's exactly. Chaos theory shows that even in deterministic systems, tiny initial differences can lead to wildly unpredictable outcomes long term. Think the butterfly effect. Prediction is impossible for complex systems like weather or brains.
And quantum mechanics adds another layer of uncertainty.
Right. At the quantum level, events are probabilistic, not strictly determined. Some physicists explore deterministic interpretations, but they often involve strange ideas like instant connections across the universe.
So predicting brain decisions seems fundamentally impossible.
The conclusion is yes. For complex systems like the brain, with chaotic processes and neural noise, brain states are realistically definable only in probabilities. So even if the brain follows physical laws, complexity might create something that feels like unpredictability.
Okay, so if strict prediction is out, does that leave room for free will? This is where compatibilism comes in, trying to reconcile determinism and free will.
Yes, compatibilism, or weak determinism, tries to find a middle ground. It redefines free will so it can coexist with determinism.
How does it do that?
The source brings up Hume again. He argued our mental events are free if they come from our own intentions, beliefs, desires, feelings.
So free if they come from within us.
Right, as long as they're not forced by external pressure or coercion. Hume did acknowledge internal compulsions, like addiction or severe disorders, can also limit freedom, even without external force.
So compatibilists focus on the source of the action.
That's the key insight. If it comes from our internal character and desires, even in a deterministic universe, it can still be considered free in a meaningful way.
But the source then emphasizes how hard it is to know all the causes of our behavior.
Extremely hard. We're unaware of most brain processes. Our activity is influenced by countless internal and external factors, often non-linearly small causes, big effects.
Makes tracing the exact reasons tough.
Very. The child-environment interaction is a good example. The child shapes the environment. The environment shapes the child. That's a complex web. Add in chaos and neural noise and deterministic prediction seems impossible. We just lack conscious access to most of what's going on inside.
That lack of access feels really important. If we don't know why we did something, how can we be sure it was free?
Good question. The source notes that quick actions don't usually involve conscious willing of muscle movements. But for slower, deliberate actions, our choices get filtered through our personality, beliefs, values.
So free actions should align with those internal states.
Generally, yes, if they're unforced. Our choices depend on our internal state, desires, beliefs, and external circumstances. Sometimes, maybe even random chance plays a part.
And setting a goal gives a strong feeling of will.
Definitely. Pursuing a goal connects our actions, beliefs, and that feeling of agency. That's a key insight.
Now, on the other side, from compatibilism, we have libertarianism, the idea of completely free, undetermined choice.
Yes. Libertarianism tries to establish free choice that isn't caused by anything prior. Some hope for evidence of a non-physical mind, maybe through panpsychism.
Consciousness in all matter.
Right. But the source sees that as unproductive currently. Others look to quantum uncertainty, but that hasn't yielded a solid theory of libertarian free will either in the last 50 years.
So big challenges for libertarianism.
Significant ones, yes. The key takeaway is it struggles for a scientifically plausible mechanism.
And the source raises a really interesting counterpoint. If our will isn't conditioned by anything, is it really our will?
Exactly. A choice with absolutely no cause would just be random, disconnected from the person. The source argues some determinism, our beliefs influencing actions, might actually be necessary for meaningful free choice.
How can you even imagine a truly uncaused decision?
You really can't. It wouldn't feel like ours, any more than a fully determined action forced upon us. Philosophers call free will aporetic. It presents impossible difficulties either way.
So both complete determinism and complete indeterminism are problematic.
That's the core philosophical puzzle, a key insight.
This is deep. Now, what about spontaneous thoughts and desires? Those things that just pop into our heads.
Do we control those? The source questions, if we can consciously will a spontaneous thought. What does spontaneous even mean here?
Good point. Where do they come from?
Maybe unconscious causes? Weak, widespread brain activity, like tiny ripples making a big wave. It also mentions the infinite regress problem. To want something, you first have to want that desire and so on. An endless loop.
And it's hard to suppress them, like trying to just count breaths.
Extremely hard. the mind wanders. It requires serious training to overcome the unconscious processes pulling our attention. The takeaway is, much of our mental life arises without conscious command.
That resonates with anyone who's tried meditating. So hard to quiet the mind. This brings up responsibility. How does determinism affect who's responsible?
Responsibility, the source says, needs both control and understanding consequences. We might feel guilty for forgetting something, even if remembering isn't always fully willed.
Why?
The idea is that unpleasant consequences motivate future behavior change. Blame is fundamental for planning change, individually and socially.
What about impulsive actions?
It distinguishes impulsive acts, where control might be weaker, from our ability to learn by understanding outcomes. Children, or those with cognitive impairments who don't fully grasp consequences, are often held less responsible.
So responsibility depends on perceived control and understanding.
That seems to be the link, yes. We operate assuming people have some free will, but understanding consequences is a spectrum.
So this internal feeling of free will, what's its relation to actual brain processes, according to the source?
It argues the feeling, while real to us, is actually secondary to brain decisions. But it should generally align with our broader intentions and acceptable action plans.
What about when it doesn't align?
Neuropsychological disorders like alien hand syndrome, where a hand acts on its own, or Tourette's, with involuntary tics, show actions clearly contrary to conscious will. They don't feel like one's own willed actions.
And the Huxley quote.
Thomas Huxley suggested the feeling of will isn't the cause, but a symbol in consciousness of the underlying brain activity that is the cause.
Wow, the feeling as an observer, not the driver.
That's the powerful idea, yes. The key takeaway is our subjective experience of willing might be an awareness of processes already underway, not the starting point.
And the source says our brains plan actions unconsciously?
Yes, constantly anticipating and developing plans heavily influenced by past experience. The final choice might be unpredictable, even to us. But it's not undetermined. It arises from brain states and the situation.
Our brains are complex.
Incredibly. Behavior results from vast interactions. We make small decisions all day, but reflecting on them, we tend to choose consistently with our values, creating a coherent narrative. That's who I am.
The correlation isn't causation, right? Like thunder and lightning.
Exactly. Neuroscience reveals unconscious volition. Action plans form seconds before conscious awareness. The readiness potential builds up about half a second before we feel the intention to move.
So planning and initiation happen largely unconsciously.
That's the key takeaway. A significant amount happens before we're consciously aware.
That readiness potential has sparked so much debate. The source then looks at when we do feel that sense of will, of making a decision.
It describes a spectrum. From automatic responses, no strong feeling of will, just one immediate action.
Like reacting to a loud noise.
Right, driven by established circuits. Two conscious decisions, which do come with a sense of will. Here, the brain might generate several options. We become aware of alternatives. Maybe there's conflict or uncertainty.
Higher stakes, maybe.
Often, the final choice feels strongly linked to ourself. We need to own the outcome, integrate it into our story, which is crucial for learning. But even these felt decisions result from complex, largely inaccessible brain processes.
So the feeling of will is strongest when we're aware of options and evaluating.
That seems to be the association, yes. Even though the underlying neural stuff is still mostly unconscious.
So the source suggests this whole mystery of free will might be partly how we frame it, how we think about ourselves.
Yes, potentially echoing that old ghost in the machine idea, a separate mind controlling the body. The problem might arise when we attribute actions to a little inner agent, a homunculus making decisions.
So understanding self is key.
Crucial, the source argues, quoting Freud. We're not master in our own house. Conscious awareness is just a fraction of mental activity. The self is just one of many interconnected brain processes, mostly unconscious.
We can learn to spot imbalances sometimes.
Maybe recognize early signs.
Yeah.
Yes, which gives a sense of intervention. But even that recognition is a brain process. Brain activity leads to actions, interpreted by our self model and memory. Decisions become my history, even if rationalized later.
Which brain areas are involved?
Frontal cortex, supplementary motor area, prefrontal cortex are crucial. Conscious decisions often arise from unconscious tendencies. Emotional rationalization, cost-benefit analysis, social rules, even random neural fluctuations. It's a spectrum from weakly to fully determined processes.
So the self and will are tangled up with unconscious brain stuff.
That's the key takeaway.
And this feeling of consciously choosing seems to fade as actions become automatic, like habits.
Exactly. Automation saves mental energy, but reduces the feeling of willed action. Novel or important decisions, though, require conscious reflection and bring a stronger feeling of will as we weigh options.
So the feeling is strongest during conscious deliberation about significant choices.
That's the idea.
The source also discusses disruptions, illusions of control, like Wegner's work.
Yes, Daniel Wegner's research is key here. We feel our thought caused an action if the thought is consistent and perceives it. But this can lead to errors.
Like thinking we caused something we didn't, or denying something we did.
Exactly. Wegner's experiments manipulated timing and consistency to change people's sense of will. The joystick demo is a classic. Even TMS magnetic brain stimulation can mess with the perceived timing of our intention.
So our feeling of agency isn't always reliable.
Surprisingly malleable, yes. That's the key takeaway.
So consciousness, identity, volition, they're all interconnected, distributed brain processes, not in one spot.
Precisely. No single will center. They emerge from the whole brain and organism working together. Conscious processes are just one part.
Which leads back to that question. If the brain creates the feeling of will, how are we responsible?
This often comes from thinking of self as separate from the body, denying parts of ourselves. Brain damage or dissociative disorders show how the sense of self can fragment.
So the brain preparing for situations shouldn't seem strange.
No, actions come from the whole organism. Do intentions need to be conscious to be mine? That's a fundamental question. Our sense of self is deeply tied to our physical being and unconscious brain processes.
That's crucial. Do intentions have to be conscious to be ours?
The source points out, sometimes we plan consciously, then act. More often, we act based on underlying tendencies without full awareness of the brain's plan.
Then we rationalize afterwards.
Often, yeah. Creating a plausible story. Or we just act, then wonder why. The brain processes info, initiates actions, and usually it reaches awareness eventually.
But sometimes we act against conscious desires.
Yes, and regret it. I didn't want to do that. Suggests a disconnect. Do we always know what we want? We can't consciously plan every detail we just act, speak grammatically without planning each word.
So consciousness often interprets rather than commands.
Much of behavior is unconscious. Awareness often follows. That's a key insight.
Consciousness allows for correction, evaluation, but maybe not detailed planning.
Exactly. The difference between planning versus acting then reflecting might be smaller at the brain level than we think. Conscious perception, the source suggests, is always of internal brain processes triggered by internal or external events.
And many causes are hidden, non-verbalizable.
Yes, maybe from many weak, widespread activations. Like the 20 questions game analogy, unrelated answers lead to the concept. Unrelated brain activations coalesce into an action or thought.
So conscious understanding is just the tip of the iceberg.
That's the picture painted.
This idea of hidden causes leads to moral intuition and unconscious bias.
Yes. People make moral judgments quickly. Gut feelings, not reasoning. Joshua Hauser's research shows education, culture influence these intuitions, but people struggle to explain why they feel a certain way.
Unconscious processes shaping moral decisions before conscious thought engages.
Exactly.
And then the source introduces the extended mind. What's that?
Or the great mind. It includes not just conscious thoughts, but the vast unconscious realm. And it suggests our mind isn't just in our skull. It extends to interactions with others, the environment.
The whole world influencing our mental state.
To some extent, yeah. The Indra's net metaphor, everything interconnected, reflecting everything else, though influence varies.
So free choice becomes freedom from compulsion, internal and external.
Yes, including neurotic impulses. That's the goal of many spiritual paths, liberation. Clinging to an illusion of unconstrained free will, ignoring influences, is problematic.
Internal compulsions can be as strong as external ones.
Absolutely. Like addiction or anxiety. Believing willpower alone is enough, without help, is often misguided. Spirit over matter is rare in the real world.
So our minds are wider, more influenced than we usually think.
That's the key insight.
And this isn't totally new. It connects to Zen.
Exactly. Moving beyond the illusion of a fixed conscious self is central to Zen. Shunryu Suzuki's opening the small mind to the great mind that encompasses everything.
The great mind isn't fully graspable intellectually.
No, we can't consciously know all our brain workings.
Mm-hmm.
It's expressed through actions, ideally non-egoistically, through awareness, Freedom isn't unlimited choice, but not being enslaved by neurotic impulses, addictions.
But consciously accepting discomfort for worthy goals.
Right. These ideas existed intuitively for centuries. Now science is developing a framework. The insight is ancient wisdom and modern science converging on freedom as understanding and transcending internal limits, not clinging to absolute, uncaused choice.
And this deeper understanding brings greater responsibility.
Yes, for all our actions, not just illusions about self. Remember, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Even well-meaning actions can harm.
So if we can't control bad impulses, we need limitations.
The responsible course might be seeking support. We're responsible for the self we're cultivating, for personal spiritual development as much as we can consciously influence it.
But childhood shaping is hard to change.
Very. Deeply ingrained habits resist conscious effort. Practices like mindfulness or Zen meditation, shikantaza, just sitting, aim to free us from internal compulsions, emotional reactions, maybe leading towards nirvana.
And these aren't necessarily religious.
No, they're methods for regulating mental states, independent of belief. The takeaway is understanding our minds leads to broader responsibility for actions and inner life.
So what are the wider implications of cognitive science for ethics, morality, responsibility, human nature?
Profound implications requiring deep thought. It's sparking new fields. Neurophilosophy, neuroethics, neuroaesthetics, even neurotheology, all recent.
Understanding how minds work changes how we see ourselves.
Fundamentally. For the first time, we're getting a more nuanced grasp of the causes of behavior, decisions, beliefs, even our core philosophies. Cognitive science is a new lens on age-old questions.
And with this broader understanding, maybe we gain more freedom from those influences.
Precisely. Seeing the context allows reflection on our biases. We can learn to partly free ourselves from neurotic impulses, expand our freedom's boundaries.
Shaping character to align with values like the Christian man of truth, or Buddhist vessel of Dharma.
Those are examples of the aspiration. Interestingly, belief in unconditioned free will, even as scientifically shaky, has played a social role, fostering responsibility, supporting reward-punishment systems, social cohesion.
So understanding influences can paradoxically lead to more aligned actions.
That's the key takeaway. It's complex, but self-awareness can empower.
Okay, let's pivot now and dive more into the neuroscience of will and decision-making. How do sensory systems prepare us for action?
Their main job is gathering info and creating internal representations to help us react appropriately. Most reactions are automatic adjusting balance, pulling away from heat.
Not consciously decided.
Right. Muscle control varies too. Rhythmic, like breathing. Automatic reflexes in the brainstem spinal cord. And then volitional movements, seemingly consciously initiated. That's our focus here.
So not all movement is consciously willed.
Many are automatic for efficiency, survival. That's the insight.
And movement control is hierarchical in the brain.
It is. Spinal cord handles simple reflexes, gets signals from the brainstem, which controls balance, houses dopamine producers.
Dopamine's important for movement.
Crucial. Then voluntary movement signals often come from the cortex. Mm-hmm. Primary motor cortex, M1, premotor cortex, supplementary motor area, SMA.
Working with deeper structures.
Yes. Basal ganglia, cerebellum, refined movements. Premotor cortex connects to the parietal cortex for spatial awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Sensory cortex gives feedback, proprioception.
And at the top.
Prefrontal cortex, PFC, high-level planning. Intentions into movement. Damage to M1 causes weakness, hemiparesis. Damage to premotor SMA causes apraxia, difficulty with purposeful moves despite muscle strength.
So conscious movement involves a complex network.
Working hierarchically, yes.
So PFC initiates intentional actions. But where do intentions come from? It feels like I direct decisions.
The million-dollar question. The source reminds us how hard it is to control thoughts. They just pop up.
Try not thinking of a blue elephant.
Exactly. It keeps intruding. Desires, urges often arise spontaneously too. We become aware of wanting something without deciding to feel that way.
The monkey mind.
Ancient philosophies recognized it. The key insight. Many mental states, including action precursors, arise spontaneously, not from conscious command.
So given this spontaneity, what does science say about free will? Does our feeling of initiating actions match brain processes?
Well, will is a psychological construct describing complex brain events. Experiments explore if the feeling of will precedes action or just follows it.
Do we do what we want or want what we do?
That's the fundamental question being probed. How are actions initiated? That's crucial.
This brings us to early experiments like Gray Walter's projector.
Yes, 1963. An M1 signal directly controlled a projector. People felt the machine anticipated their decision before they were consciously aware of making it.
Uncanny.
Hints the brain might prepare actions before awareness catches up. That's the surprising takeaway.
And then Libet's famous experiments, similar time lag.
Exactly. Using EEG, Libet focused on the readiness potential, RP, that slow buildup in motor cortex before voluntary movement.
And the key finding?
RP started about 300 milliseconds before people reported conscious awareness of deciding to move. Suggests the brain prepares before conscious will arises.
And there was another delay.
Yes, about 500 meters between direct M1 stimulation and conscious sensation. It takes time for the brain to interpret its own activity. Short, random bursts aren't consciously registered.
Did Libet think will had no role?
He proposed it might not initiate, but could veto an action once we become aware of the urge. The key insight, that significant delay challenges conscious will as the immediate initiator.
But Libet's interpretations have faced criticism.
Several critiques, yes. Truvina and Miller argued in 2002 that RP isn't only linked to decisions to move. It can happen when you prepare but don't move.
So is RP really a sign of an unconscious decision?
That's the debate, a key point of contention.
And fMRI studies looking deeper in the brain add more complexity.
Indeed. fMRI shows frontal lobe areas involved in planning even earlier than the RP. Soon at all. In 2008, predicted simple choices like which hand to use up to 10 seconds before conscious decision reported.
10 seconds.
Yeah, that extended time frame further complicates the picture of conscious will initiating action. The takeaway. Growing evidence, the brain plans decisions long before we're consciously aware.
That's a huge lead time. Makes you wonder about the role of conscious will. Maybe it's more about veto power, like Libet suggested, approving or stopping brain-initiated actions.
The source considers the veto idea, but finds it doubtful as a full explanation. Not willing is likely just competition between brain processes. One inhibits the other.
So inhibition is still a brain process?
Likely. We might be aware of the urge and reasons not to act. Neural activity for both builds up. The final choice is quick. Small differences tip the balance.
And this isn't uniquely human.
Probably involves similar neurophysiological mechanisms as in animals. Also, RPs can arise spontaneously in certain contexts, like focusing on the urge. Urge strength correlates with RP size.
Like a sea wave building up.
Good analogy. Fluctuations reach a threshold, trigger movement, then perceived as intentional. The insight, even not willing, involved neural competition.
The source lays out a hypothetical sequence of brain events for a willed action.
Yes, proposed, not fully proven. 10 through 2 seconds before. PFC develops potential plans, left, right hand. 2, 1 seconds before. Premotor SMA show weak activation for a sequence. 1.5 seconds before. Imbalance builds. RP grows for one plan, stimulating M1. 0.50 seconds. M1 activates inferior parietal cortex, IPC, causing feeling of intention in space, then muscle contracts.
Then feedback reinforces the feeling.
Right. Sensory feedback and direct M1 activation hit the somatosensory cortex, SI, strengthening IPC activity, creating a stronger my decision feeling. But proving this chain is technically hard.
So it's a model showing complex timing and interplay across regions.
Exactly. That's the takeaway.
These detailed experiments focus on simple, conscious lab actions. What about messy everyday life, automatic driving, etc.?
Crucial point. Daily life is full of automatic actions, often without attention. Driving while thinking about something else. We might only realize an action afterwards, but still feel it's ours.
Playing music from memory.
Good example. Focus on melody, but can consciously correct errors. Specific intentions aren't always conscious, but the action feels like it belongs to the whole organism. Our sense of agency extends beyond consciously detailed actions.
And TMS experiments add another layer, making people feel free choice even when stimulated.
Yes, stimulating a hand choice, people felt free 80% of time. Stimulating right DLPFC affects risk-taking, suggests our subjective feeling of freedom can be influenced by manipulating brain activity.
So the feeling might not perfectly match the underlying cause.
That's the implication.
This sense of I acting agency, where does that come from in the brain?
Research points to posterior parietal cortex, PPC, and temporoparietal junction, TPJ, especially the right hemisphere. Crucial for distinguishing self versus other initiated actions, analyzing others' actions, social interaction.
TPJ is an integration hub.
Yes, integrates senses, spatial relations, internal states. Left TPJs, including Wernicke's area, involved in verbalizing internal states, understanding concepts.
Yeah.
Damage causes weird issues, not recognizing body parts, anosognosia, alien hand.
And specific areas related to awareness of own action.
Anterior insular cortex, AIC activity, seems linked to awareness of own volitional action, like drawing. inferior parietal cortex, IPC activity, linked to awareness of passive movement. AIC might integrate sensory input for own actions. IPC might represent movement spatially, independent of self-position.
So agency involves a network distinguishing self-other and integrating intention, movement, sensation.
That seems to be the picture emerging.
And directly stimulating these parietal areas can evoke the feeling of wanting to move.
Exactly. Stimulating right parietal areas, 7, 39, 40, gives a strong urge to move a limb. Left side, urge to move lip speak. More stimulation led some to believe they had acted without muscle activity.
While stimulating premotor cortex causes movement, but they deny moving.
Right. And parietal lesions can make thought lead directly to action. Shows a close link between intention and execution, maybe bypassing normal control. Parietal cortex is key for the subjective experience of wanting to move and agency.
This all raises that huge ethical question. If actions aren't always consciously willed, what about moral responsibility?
The source argues we're still generally held responsible, whether actions are conscious or impulsive. Some studies suggest undermining belief in free will increases cheating.
But those are controversial.
Yes, debated. Stronger belief in free will is linked to pro-social behavior, motivation, self-control. Responsibility seems tied to sense of agency, I did it, and awareness of consequences.
There is a study about electric shocks and determinism.
Yes. Reading about determinism affected willingness to punish or seek revenge, though results varied and could be framed differently. Maybe thinking, I'm good, I had no choice, reduces desire for retribution.
So the link between free will beliefs and moral judgment is complex and evolving.
Absolutely. That's the key takeaway.
Okay, let's shift to how the brain makes decisions. How does it choose between options?
Sensory info relevant to options gets integrated in the parietal lobe. An experiment associating face places with hand-eye movements showed parietal neurons weren't just seeing faces, but calculating preference for the action based on learned links.
So even arbitrary decisions involve sensorimotor mechanisms conditioned by context.
That's what it suggests, yes. Decision-making integrates sensory info with learned associations to guide action.
And we're often not conscious of the immediate past when reacting quickly.
Right, like regaining balance or pulling from heat.
Yeah.
Consciousness lags slightly behind the event, as Susan Blackmore noted. The action happens, then we're aware. But these actions usually align with our overall will. Awareness might be evaluating the reaction, not initiating it.
So many immediate responses are unconscious reflexes registered later.
That's the idea.
So important to distinguish levels of decision making, fast reactions versus considered choices.
Absolutely. Unconscious rapid reactions versus conscious reflective deliberations. Conscious choice takes time to weigh options, consequences.
But even free actions can have unconscious roots.
Yes, and we can use reflection to evaluate those initial impulses, correct course. The addict example, craving versus conscious desire to quit. Conscious thoughts matter, even if from unconscious mechanisms.
Reflection allows decisions aligned with values.
Yes. If no time for reflection, we often accept the body's reaction. Later regret or realizing mistakes is crucial for learning, changing behavior involving guilt, regret. Implicit bias tests reveal hidden biases we might not endorse.
So it's an interplay between fast unconscious and slow conscious evaluation.
Both contributing to the overall process. That's the key takeaway.
Which leads back to predictability. If we knew everything, could we predict behavior perfectly?
The weather analogy comes up again. Even with tons of data, chaos limits long-term weather prediction. Short-term is okay, long-term unreliable.
Human behavior is similar.
Even more complex.
Right.
We can only measure limited internal factors, neurotransmitters, hormones, connections, neuron excitability, plus constant unpredictable environmental interactions.
So perfect prediction seems impossible in practice.
Likely, yes. Even if governed by cause and effect, the complexity and chaos probably make it practically impossible.
And our unawareness of many subtle influencing factors contributes to the feeling of free will.
Exactly. Countless unidentified factors nudge us. Weak influences show up in large groups like the Valentine's Avenue priming study, increasing helping behavior.
Or holding a warm versus cold drink affecting impressions.
Right. And basic physiological factors can be surprisingly predictive. The Israeli parole board study, where parole chances drop near zero before lunch due to hunger.
Wow. We're often unaware of these significant influences.
And that lack of awareness might bolster our feeling of being in complete control.
So, while full prediction is out, the source suggests no room for non-physical influences.
That's the perspective presented. Decisions, deliberate or spontaneous, arise from physical brain-body processes, influenced by genes, environment, experience.
Like a chess game with time limits. Quick decisions versus important ones.
Good analogy. Quick relies on pattern recognition. Big life moral decisions depend on well-formed habits, character, life wisdom, shaped by self-awareness, learning, brain plasticity. It emphasizes physical biological foundations.
And decision-making self-control require energy. Glucose.
Yes, they seem energy intensive. Some studies even suggest sugary drinks can temporarily reduce stereotypical thinking, maybe by fueling the brain. Physical state impacts cognitive abilities.
So, can we overcome unwanted neurotic impulses?
The source suggests training attention and mindfulness is key. Practices from traditions like mindfulness meditation or Zen, Shikan Taza, just sitting.
Developing awareness without judgment.
Right. And research supports benefits, independent of religion. The idea is training attention might help us recognize and regulate impulses.
Is rational conscious decision always best?
Not necessarily. Most thinking is unconscious associations.
Mm-hmm.
Creativity often relies on this. Intuitive decisions, drawing on this network, can be more satisfying in complex cases.
Like research from the Nijmegen Unconscious Lab.
Exactly. Even deductive reasoning might use language mainly for initial encoding, then nonverbal mental operations take over. Unconscious thinking is a powerful tool. Relying only on rationality might limit us.
What about willpower, resisting temptation for long-term goals?
Crucial. The Dunedin study linked childhood willpower to adult success, strengthening it. Self-talk might be less effective than an open attitude or internal inspiration.
So willpower is complex, influenced by many factors.
And different strategies work for different people.
The source also mentions diseases of will, framing addictions as disorders of self-control.
Yes, the DSM-V increasingly sees addiction involving impaired self-control. It lists behavioral addictions, gambling, gaming, internet, substance addictions, impulse control disorders, kleptomania, OCD spectrum.
And weakened will can be part of other illnesses.
Depression, schizophrenia, frontal lobe damage too. Our capacity for willpower isn't unlimited. It can be significantly affected by psychological and neurological conditions.
Finally, what determines spontaneous decisions and urges?
Probability depends on brain state genes interacting with environment. Brain state is influenced by past experiences and temporary random factors, neurotransmitters, fatigue, nutrition.
So it's probabilistic, not fully deterministic.
Yes, due to stochastic factors. Decisions are based on these evolving brain states, nudged by many influences, tending towards consistency with norms, ideals, values, social conformity. Consciousness, attention, will are all interconnected in these complex processes.
The source also mentions environmental dependency syndrome.
Zeelig syndrome, yeah. A fascinating disorder where patients lose volition, controlled by environmental cues. Seeing a bed leads to lying down. Seeing water compels drinking.
What causes that?
Studies suggest executive dysfunction interacting with attribution errors, maybe linked to frontotemporal dementia, shows how brain damage can severely impair self-initiated action, making us reliant on triggers.
And this section concludes with three views on will.
First, biological reductionism, full physical determinism, no free will, consciousness just a byproduct. Second, traditional view, my will arises without cause, but how is it mine? Third, probabilistic social determinism,
which the source leans towards.
Seems so. Brain generates action plans, evaluated by self-processes for consistency with values. Decision is free if no external compulsion. After considering consequences, following internal compass, there are fundamentally different ways to understand will.
This probabilistic view aligns somewhat with William James's two-stage model.
Yes, 1884. First stage, random generation of alternatives. Second stage, will decision selects one. Similar models exist, like the BVSR model for creativity, blind variation, selective retention.
And Robert Doyle elaborated on this.
Yes, in Free Will, The Scandal in Philosophy,
right,
emphasizes chance, neural stochasticity, allowing choices made according to beliefs, pushing strict determinism back.
Uh-huh.
Uses the analogy of bacteria with random movements directed by sensors towards goals, chance, and purpose coexisting.
So randomness provides options, then we choose based on values.
That's the core idea.
But the source notes a weakness in Doyle's approach.
Yes. Focuses on quantum indeterminacy, but doesn't fully address identity, self-formation, or the big influence of genetic neuronal predispositions shaped by biology and experience.
Leans towards libertarianism without explaining why certain options arise.
Right. Doesn't fully account for social factors, upbringing, brain plasticity, shaping the very beliefs we choose from. Randomness might play a role, but we also need to understand what shapes our preferences and available options.
The discussion then turns to errors in judgment, systematic bias, and random noise.
Systematic errors come from cognitive biases leading to consistent mistakes, like in-group favoritism, tracked in things like gender pay gaps. The implicit association test, IAT, measures unconscious associations, though interpretation is complex.
And random noise.
Adds variability even without bias, from personality, habits, momentary physiological state. AI trying to predict judges' sentencing reflects this neurodeterministic influence. Hunger, fatigue, mood also affect decisions significantly.
So judgments aren't always rational or consistent.
Influenced by both predictable bias and unpredictable noise.
And social and religious norms have powerful influence. Conformity versus skepticism.
Exactly. Social neuroscience studies this. Collective illusions. Todd Rose's concept uses superstitions as examples of shared beliefs lacking factual basis, persisting due to social acceptance.
And these illusions can be about more than superstitions.
Oh, yes. Social policies, etc. Positive deviance is mentioned as a way to change harmful norms by promoting those already acting differently. Our beliefs are strongly influenced by norms, sometimes based on widespread misperceptions.
This leads to the stability-plasticity dilemma for beliefs.
Yes. Tension between stability, functioning based on past, and plasticity, adapting to new info. Confirmation bias maintains stability. Learning from elders is good, but questioning is vital in changing times.
And today's challenge, easy spread of misinformation.
Right. Excessive plasticity can lead to accepting fantasy over facts. Need balance between holding useful knowledge and being open to updates.
The source also explores dopamine and genes influencing belief persistence.
Yes, PFC, working memory, and striatum, reward learning, use dopamine. PFC influences striatal learning about relevant cues. Dopamine signals reward prediction error. Genes like COMT, DARPP32, DRD2 affect dopamine processing, influencing how we stick to cues or learn from outcomes.
Variations linked to creativity, achievement.
Some correlations found, yeah. Tendency to believe without evidence might have a partial genetic basis, maybe linked to dopamine response.
And genetics influencing religiosity more than environment.
Suggests inclination isn't just conscious choice. Contrasts grace of faith with genetic neuroscience explanations. Twin studies link religiosity to VMAT2 protein. Neurotransmitter transport. Stronger correlation in identical twins suggests genetic component.
Research is looking for brain function correlations, too.
Yes, believers versus skeptics. Latent learning, pattern seeking mentioned. A study linked perceiving order in dots to belief in divine intervention. Religious fundamentalists might show lower cognitive flexibility, different error processing brainwaves.
So belief predispositions seem influenced by genes and brain function, maybe involving dopamine.
That's the complex picture emerging.
Finally, this section covers the tension between individual freedom and paternalism, introducing Thaler's nudge theory.
The question, assume people are rational, economer, or limit choices for their own good. Heart of welfare state versus liberty debates, like Obamacare. Cognitive illusions hinder good choices, but state intervention risks disempowerment, higher taxes, libertarianism, max freedom if no harm to others.
Nudge theory as a middle ground, soft paternalism.
Exactly. Preserve choice, but subtly encourage beneficial behaviors via information presentation, default options, fly-in urinal, organ donation opt-out. Sweden's COVID approach mentioned as an example. Doesn't work equally well everywhere, though.
And self-talk can motivate.
Yes, but different strategies have varying effectiveness. The takeaway, ongoing debate on balancing autonomy and well-being and how subtle interventions might guide choice without restricting freedom.
Okay, our final deep dive today, self-identity in the brain, trying to understand I biologically.
Truly fascinating. Starts with, what maintains identity over time? Cells replace. Morons mostly last, but atoms change. Are we the same person as years ago with changed views, knowledge?
Feeling of unchanging self might be an illusion.
Presented that way, yeah.
Yeah.
We're more like a continuous process, many processes changing at different rates, brain most plastic. Mm. Our sense of self might be more dynamic than we feel.
Then the profound thought experiment, being born elsewhere.
Right. Why here, this body, this culture? I make sense in a different body, different culture. Probably not, the source suggests.
Same genes, different upbringing, different eye.
Likely. Temperament might be innate. But personality, beliefs, sense of self are profoundly shaped by environment, family, culture, education. The I now wasn't born fully formed. It's a product of life history.
Connects to Zen's unborn mind. Misunderstanding the self is permanent.
Exactly. Many questions about who we are might stem from that misunderstanding. Our self is deeply tied to specific experiences and environment.
So if the permanent self is illusory, How do we construct this feeling of I?
By building a self model. Interpreting internal info, sensations, thoughts, emotions, distinguishing signal from noise, weaving a coherent narrative. Also observing how the world reacts to us.
Learning from feedback, even from infancy.
Yes. Caregivers, society shape our understanding of acceptable behavior, who we are perceived to be. Self is an ongoing construction, internal experience plus external reflection.
Which leads to, do I have a brain or does my brain have me? Challenges our sense of control.
Poses it directly. Where is myself in the brain? Answer. Not one spot. Complex, multifaceted representation emerging from the whole brain and organism.
Brain scans show different patterns for self versus others.
Yes, in DMPSC, AC. Distinct but overlapping representations. Social roles handled by OMPSC. The computer game analogy helps. Graphics card temp doesn't explain the game. It's the whole system.
So intense fMRI spots aren't the whole story.
No. Self emerges from coordinated activity. Cortical midline structures, CMS, seem key in self-related tasks across domains. Verbal, spatial, emotional, face recognition. They mediate limbic, brainstem, cortex communication. Damage elsewhere doesn't always disrupt self-feeling.
So self is an emergent property of widespread activity.
That's the key insight.
And while physical brain processes underlie it, self arises at a higher mental level.
Exactly. Irreducible, like art's meaning isn't just paint chemistry. Most decisions aren't explainable only physically. Processes link across regions, forming a whole. If I is the whole person, not just self-image, maybe free will versus determinism dissolves.
Quoting Aquinas, I am not my soul. Identity tied to the whole being.
Suggests that, yeah. The self might be best seen as the integrated experience of our whole organism.
This idea of self extending beyond the brain, even the body, is intriguing.
Yes. Hands, heart, brain, all me. Maybe things strongly influencing us are partly me too, memory aids, social connections, graded influence, fuzzy belonging.
If self includes organism plus environment parts, responsibility makes more sense.
Yes. Even choosing info intake, films, is part of it. Freedom becomes social, relational, not just physical. Our self might be more porous, connected than we realize.
So my brain's decisions are still my decisions, and I'm responsible.
That's the central argument. The error is assuming if conscious I doesn't know all brain processes, the action isn't mine. By that logic, almost nothing unplanned is ours. Even thoughts arise spontaneously.
Regretted actions attributed to temptation, not me, means inaccurate self-image.
The source interprets it that way. Highlights need for self-knowledge, impulse control to align actions with desired self. Psychological integration. Responsible for actions, not just flawed self-image.
So actions evaluated mentally for consequences and values.
Exactly. Brain processes are physical. Meaning is mental. Stronger my thinking feeling comes from associative thought sequences, also spontaneous associations based on brain structure. Lack of verification leads to errors, regret. Underscores need for customs promoting reflection, conscience, stability.
Significance and responsibility evaluated at the conscious level.
Right.
The source outlines levels of choice in brain-planned actions, instinctive to reflective.
Yes, a spectrum. Instinctive, fast, innate, learned actions become reflexive, maybe brief hesitation. Deliberate actions, imagine consequences, take time. Reflection, conscious thought, moral dilemmas, longer consideration.
Maturing involves controlling impulses, aligning automatic actions with values.
A big part of it, yes. Personality integration, Jung's individuation, spiritual maturation, Thich Nhat Hanh's purifying mind. Our capacity for conscious choice develops, allowing alignment.
Why does the brain need an I, evolutionary purpose?
Likely crucial for survival. Awareness of action, self-other distinction, evaluating possibilities, social interaction, all vital. Depersonalization disorder perhaps illustrates the impairment without it. The sense of self likely evolved for adaptive advantages.
Finally, information in the expanding universe and free choice.
The idea. As the universe expands, information increases. Free choice might be selecting brain plans from possibilities generated by non-deterministic processes. Neural, thermal, quantum noise. Future not fixed. More info possible.
Early low entropy allowed complexity.
Yes. Expanding universe prevents Zermelo's recurrence paradox, returning to same state. Creates potential for new info. Total determinism impossible. Future open. Choices aren't random, but selections based on history situation within possibilities.
So universal expansion might provide a basis for genuine choice.
That's the intriguing suggestion.
The source also asks, do Do people have opinions before being asked? Group affiliation effects.
Notes that question situations can create opinions. Stated preferences differ from actual behavior. Polls have limits. Group affiliation powerfully sways rational thought. Partisan divides example. Mm-hmm. Opinions are often context-dependent, influenced socially.
And Project Implicit's IATs reveal unconscious biases.
Yes. Measures unconscious social associations. Race, gender, etc. Interpretation is complex, though. Episodic memory becoming semantic means repeated messages, even false, become ingrained, trigger associations. Repetition matters more than facts sometimes. Media focus on rare events distorts perception.
So unconscious associations, shaped by experience info, influence us unaware.
Significantly.
Can we free ourselves from this tyranny of the brain, stereotypes, habits, urges?
Traditional psychiatry focuses on life-disrupting issues. Total integration is more a goal of spiritual practice. Transpersonal psychotherapy involves consciously shaping ourselves, changing the brain, filtering info intake. Understanding collective illusions helps.
We have some agency in self-development.
Yes, becoming more aware of shaping forces.
Which leads to Todd Rose on collective illusions.
His research highlights individuality, mismatch between personal success definition and perceived societal values. His lab found huge gaps. Over half of 61 success attributes ranked 20-plus positions differently. Personal versus perceived societal.
Luxury goods, fame low personally, high perceived societal.
Exactly. Meaningful life for individuals, impact, enjoyment, purpose, community, character, wealth status low personally, yet we overestimate status importance for others. Prestige diplomas low personally, high perceived societal, parenting high, marriage mid.
And these illusions have negative impacts.
Strong ones. ORS salts, underprescribed. Kidney transplants wasted due to mistaken beliefs about others' views trust. Bottled water preference, historical segregation, women's suffrage opposition, all linked to collective illusions. Conformity, hiding doubts due to need for belonging, fuels it.
Understanding leads to more individualization.
Rose argues, yes, personalized medicine, education, work, technology can help. The takeaway, pervasive impact of misperceiving others' values, hindering individual and societal progress.
Lastly, reinforcement sensitivity theory and personal reflection questions for you, the listener.
RST links personality, anxiety, impulsivity to brain systems for reward, punishment, motivation. The source prompts you to reflect. Your view of will versus experiments, intention before finger move, source of urges, environment physiology influence, identity factors, identity consistency, collective illusions you see, important questions to ponder.
And just before we wrap up, some review questions to reinforce key concepts.
Right. Recalling Hume on free will, types of determinism, key brain areas, decision agency, Libet's findings, predictability limits, probabilistic social determinism, extended mind, self and brain, religiosity influences, belief persistence factors, Aquinas on soul. Great way to review.
So as we finish this deep dive into the huge topic of free will, what are the key takeaways for our listener?
I think the overwhelming complexity is central. How conscious experience is tied to unconscious processes, how biology, society, experience shape us. It's intricate, and the exploration is ongoing. No easy answers.
And as always, this was driven by your curiosity and the sources you shared.
Our final thought for you is maybe to keep observing your own decision-making. Notice the influences. Perhaps the most empowering insight isn't definitively if free will exists absolutely, but how understanding its complexities can lead to more conscious, aligned, and maybe more fulfilling actions in your own life.
Absolutely. And if you're curious for more, new fields like neurophilosophy, neuroethics are emerging, plenty more to explore. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.